Hey, everybody!
Hey!
Or Aingai.
Aingai.
Which means hi and bye in Inuktitut, which is the language of the Inuit.
Cool.
And Nakormik for listening, which means thank you.
Nakormik for listening.
Really stumbled across some awesome tourism videos for Nunavut. Which are like, here's some simple phrases.
Do you want to go now? Is it on our travel list?
I've always wanted to go to the Arctic.
Okay.
I'm very excited to go to the Arctic one day.
Yeah.
Alaska, Northern Canada, North Pole, I'll go.
Would you go to Antarctica?
Yeah, I would totally go to Antarctica.
Me too. My mom, I don't like the cold, obviously,
right.
But it's different.
Yeah.
It's freaking Antarctica.
Yeah, no, you have to go. I like the cold. I mean, I don't think anybody likes that cold.
That cold.
But I don't think everybody's like, ooh, I feel so cozy in this structure that's barely keeping my blood from freezing.
My mom once was like, listen, I want to go to Antarctica, but your dad refuses to go. Will you go with me? And
yes.
I was like, yes, I will go. And so she was talking to me about it. She's like, listen, there's a hot springs. There's a hot springs that you can swim in. And I was like, okay. So the water's warm. But what about getting out and getting in? There's a whole part of the hot springs that I'm not interested in, and it's the getting out and getting in.
I'd be like, I live in this water now, I guess, because I'm never getting out. Well, we're so excited to bring you to the Arctic, not the Antarctic, today. Mm-hmm. We're going to go north, as far north as people have been. I mean, pretty much, more or less.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to tell the story of Tukulitu and Ipirvik, who were two Inuit villagers who got to travel to England and America and work as guides for British and American explorers who were trying to uncover the mysteries of the Arctic. Mm-hmm. These two had a totally unbeatable spirit. They had amazing survival skills. And that was pretty much enough to keep even the most inept sailors alive through circumstances that seem basically totally unsurvivable.
Mm-hmm.
So I say we jump into this story. It's so exciting. I really want to hear all about these two snowbirds and their incredible adventures. So everybody bundle up. We're stepping out into the snow.
Brr, let's go.
Hey there, friends, come listen well. Eli and Diana got some stories to tell. There's no matchmaking or romantic tips. It's just about ridiculous relationships. A lover might be any type of person at all. An abstract concept or a concrete wall. But if there's a story worth a second glance, we'll put it in our show, Ridiculous Romance.
A production of iHeartRadio.
So, okay, we're talking about the Inuit today.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about way northern Canada. And the language up there is Inuktitut.
Mm-hmm.
And we are going to swing for the fences with this and do our best.
Right.
There are some great pronunciation guides out there. There's some cool videos that teach us a little bit. And then we're winging it on some of them based on those pronunciation guides kind of being like, I guess this vowel is pronounced like this.
Mm-hmm.
So we're doing our best. But but it's really fun. Like, it's actually kind of a cool language to listen to.
Yeah, it sounds
and,
cool.
I'm excited by it.
Mm-hmm. And of course, if you are Inuit, let us know.
Absolutely.
If we mispronounce something.
We would love to correct that later on. But Tukulitu was born around 1838 on Baffin Island, which is like way northeast Canada,
mm-hmm.
right across the Davis Strait from Greenland. Now, in Baffin Island, currently, they have an average temperature of 18 degrees Fahrenheit. But in July, it can get all the way up to 48. So, you know, don't pack your Speedos away just yet.
You will break a sweat.
Just real quick for our metric-using friends.
Right, we got a lot of them.
That joke is an average temperature of minus 8 degrees Celsius, which in July can get all the way up to positive 8.
Plus 8?
Yeah. Look, I don't know. I guess metric, sure. I guess water freezes at 0 and boils at 100, but I don't know why it's so hard to just remember that water freezes at 32 degrees Fahrenheit and boils at 212 degrees. That's very simple,
That's
right?
So random.
So the man who would eventually become Tukulitu's husband was born about 2 years earlier on the other side of Baffin Island near Cumberland Sound. His name was Ipirvik. A lot of English whalers came through this area, and they had a relatively positive relationship with the Inuit there. And probably should have said this earlier, but side note, the name for the indigenous people of northern Canada in this region is Inuit, which is the plural form of Inuk.
So you are an Inuk, or part of the Inuit.
Yes, as I understand it.
Okay.
Yeah. And Inuit means people. So saying Inuit people is redundant. So it's just
ATM Inuit. Machine.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And Inuit, as I've come to understand it, is not a blanket term for all of the native people of northern Canada. Mm-hmm. First Nations, Métis, and Inuit are sort of the three different groups.
Oh, I thought First Nations was the blanket term. So
no,
that's very
apparently First Peoples is a blanket term for all three of those groups. But the First Nations are a different group of people than the Inuit or than the Métis.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Yes, and it's more complicated than that, and I won't be the one to explain it to you. I'm just reading about it this week. So anyway, Epirvik was familiar with English whalers at a young age because they were always coming through Cumberland Sound where he grew up. And at some point, surely he said to one of these sailors, "Aingai, uvanga Epirvik ativa," which means, "Hello, my name is Epirvik," in my terrible Inuktitut language. But then the English then responded, "Well, I have no idea what you just said, so we'll just call you Joe."
Joe, that's not even close.
I know. They gave him the nickname Joe, and that pretty much stuck with him for the rest of his life.
In 1852, when she was about 14 years old, Tukulitu started learning English from a British whaler named William Barron. It's likely that Epirvik was already familiar with English since he had, you know, grown up around these English whalers. And at some point, Tukulitu and Epirvik were married. With living conditions being so difficult, marriage was more of a necessity than a choice in Inuit culture. Marriages were often arranged at a young age, sometimes at birth. And young women were eligible for marriage as soon as they hit puberty, while men usually were closer to 17 or 18 years old, and they had to prove themselves to be an effective hunter before they could marry. It's very interesting to me that you're sort of like, okay, you can now have babies, so that's all that's required. Mm-hmm. You need to be able to provide for the babies, so prove yourself.
Yeah.
Sort of similar to the Powhatan tribe as well.
Well, it was such, episode. You know, that what I read about Inuit culture back then especially was, it's very much about the community. Everything you do is so your individual community can thrive.
Right.
The idea of marriage, reproduction, these were all about, like, how can we survive up here? Because that's constantly what they were thinking about, because they're in terribly difficult situations to survive in all the time.
And there's not a traditional fancy ceremony, marriage ceremony, or anything like that. Often a couple would be considered married after the birth of their first child. Mm. And marriage was all about uniting the community, as you just said. Husbands and wives both could ask for a divorce, but it was frowned upon because it wasn't good for the community at large.
All right. Tukulitu's sister, Inu Luapik, had traveled to Scotland in 1839 with a whaling master named William Penny. This would have been just after Tukulitu was born. Mm. So Tukulitu grew up hearing about that, and she always wanted to take a similar voyage. Lucky for her, in 1853, an Englishman named John Bowlby showed up. Now, he had been a wine merchant, but now he was experimenting with the fishing industry. Everyone was getting into the Arctic and whaling and fishing and all this stuff. And he wanted to capitalize on that. And his plan was to build a whaling station just off Baffin Island. So he goes there, meets the Inuit people. And Tukulitu and Epirvik were well known as good translators. And they were well known as tough, adventurous types as well. So John Bowlby met them and was like, hello, maybe you should come back to England with me. And this was the opportunity of a lifetime for them. So they packed up and set sail for England.
And in England, they stayed in Hull on the east coast, north of London, with the family of the ship's doctor, William Gedney. Now, it was common at the time for native people, Inuit, Native Americans, Indians, Africans, basically any non-Western European people, to be quote-unquote exhibited in world's fairs or expos as curiosities.
Hmm.
Or explorers might bring a few natives around as like a fundraising ploy when they were trying to raise money for a voyage.
Right, right. Step right up, folks, and see who I found.
See who I found. And white people would come pay to see these folks in their native clothing, speaking their own language, or giving some, like, cultural demonstrations.
Uh-huh.
Which is funny, because they're like, I would pay to see this, but not leave you well enough alone to do it in everyday life.
Oh, that's...
Where I could see it for free, maybe, if you were my fucking neighbor, but
that's fascinating. Your culture is so interesting to me. Now I'm going to destroy it and assimilate you into mine.
Yes. So, of course, you know, it wasn't always these exhibitions or whatever were not always performed willingly by these indigenous people or Africans or whomever they were trying to put on display. But fortunately, in this instance, Tukulitu and Epirvik were willing and paid participants in these demonstrations. So yay for them. They even saw Queen Victoria and Prince Albert in London. Arctic stuff was particularly exciting in England at the time because everyone was swept up in Franklin fever.
Oh, Franklin fever. Now, the Franklin expedition was the third and final expedition of a British polar explorer named Sir John Franklin. He wanted to sail through the Northwest Passage, so cutting west from England and through all those messy clusters of islands in northern Canada, all the way over to Asia. So this would have kept them from having to go all the way down south around Europe and the southern tip of Africa to get to Asia. So it was just a way shorter route. Everyone was trying to make it work. They had all these plans. They were like, we can do it. And Sir John Franklin decided he was going to be the guy to do it. So they left in 1845, but the expedition was a huge failure. Their ships were trapped in the ice, and eventually the entire crew died. England, who didn't know the fate of the crew, offered £20,000 sterling to find and rescue survivors. That is a little over, checking here, $2 million US today.
Wow, that's quite a reward.
Yeah, so obviously this became a big deal, and everybody's talking about it through the 1840s and 50s. Over 20 expeditions would set out to either rescue the crew or find out what happened to them. So all this talk about Arctic exploration of northern Canada, of course, made Tukulitu and Epirvik extremely popular.
Yeah. Everyone was like, I can finally see the people who live there with my own two eyes.
Right, right. And should be said that I don't know what they were paid.
Right.
It may not have been great. I would definitely call this exploitation, no matter what you're doing.
I agree.
They toured these guys around and said, give me your money to see them and I'll go find more, you know. But they did seem to love it.
Okay.
They did seem to have a really positive attitude about their experience in England, and they seemed to just really enjoy it. I mean, these one thing we'll see with Tukulitu and Epirvik is their spirits are unbreakable, and they are eternal optimists. And, you know, coming from the Arctic,
right,
I think that's understandable, maybe. Like, it's probably really hard to get them down.
Yeah.
Because look at where they live 24/7.
True. They're like, I have to be happy every day and see the best and everything, or else I'd be like, why do I live on a frozen rock?
It's probably nighttime for like 5 months out of the year, I imagine.
True.
So, like,
very true.
Or at least very long, long, long nights. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you've got to, if you sink, you're not coming back up.
You sink like a stone.
Yeah, so they probably are very good at staying upbeat.
It's true.
And just appreciating things.
Yeah. Well, and you're what you said about them being exploited is just kind of calling up for me all the sideshows and also racial representation that we've talked about in the last few episodes.
Yeah.
Because it might be like that they're like, well, we're not getting paid much or whatever, but it's really helpful for people to see that the people do live in these frozen wildlands and you know, we're normal human individuals.
Right.
So even if they're not getting paid much, you know, maybe they felt like it was a good thing, for people to see them. And
maybe so.
I don't know. Okay, so John Bowlby knows he's got a hot ticket and his two Inuit friends, and he takes them around Hull and London doing these showcases for everyone to see and meet a real Inuk person. And Epirvik was described as, quote, an intelligent, quiet man, self-willed, who may be led but not driven. And they said he was, quote, a close observer of all that passes. So he sounds like a strong-willed, but like strong but silent type, maybe.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That works.
Kind of reserved, but like he sees all, he knows all.
Yeah,
kind of energy.
Right.
And Tukulitu was described as, quote, active, sprightly, and full of fun, and that, quote, her laugh is a joyous laugh.
Love it.
So I love this couple already. Uh-huh. He's just like chilling, like, okay, that guy's definitely sleeping with that guy's wife.
his first thing when he gets to England is to like do the Bravo analysis.
Yeah, he's the Bravo, and he's like to Tukulitu, and she's like, oh, for real? Look at that hat. And they seem to really enjoy their time in England, especially Tukulitu, who adapted well to English culture and style. We found a crowdfund site for a film from a few years ago by Renelta Arluck, who's an Inuit actress and director. And she said that Tukulitu liked the style she learned about in England, so she would wear a bonnet and a bustle and carried a parasol and all that kind of, like, English style stuff. Mm-hmm. But she would take the patterns home back to Baffin Island and make the same style clothes out of seal skin. So she was, like, adopting the other cultures that she learned and appreciated, but she would take it in without losing her own culture. Mm. And Renalta said, quote, in 2015 as an Inuit woman, that's still very hard to do.
Yeah, I imagine.
Yeah.
After spending 2 years in England, they had become fluent in the English language, and then they even converted to Christianity. Hmm. Many Inuit who came to Europe, either voluntarily or forcibly, ended up getting sick, of course. Many died even just from being exposed to these foreign diseases. You can imagine they
classic
don't have
yeah.
as many viruses hanging out in the below freezing temperatures in the ice, right?
Yeah.
So they come out to the warmer climates, and yeah, classic. I mean, that even happened for the Powhatans.
The colonists came. They
had
to be seasoned, quote unquote.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But Ipirvik and Tukulitu were lucky. They were totally fine. They thrived. And after 2 years, they decided they were going to go back home to their old lives. Ipirvik got back and worked as a hunter, occasionally picking up work as a translator or a guide for the whalers that came through Cumberland Sound. And soon, a whaling ship would come by with a man aboard who was going to change their lives forever. And we will meet that guy right after this commercial break. And welcome back to the show.
Ipirvik.
Welcome back to the snow, I should say.
I see what you did there.
Get it, because we're in the Arctic.
Ipirvik and Tukulitu's lives changed forever when they met an American sailor named Charles Francis Hall in 1860. Mm. And this guy was a lot of things. He was born around 1821 somewhere in Vermont or New Hampshire, and he started out young as a blacksmith's apprentice. Then, sometime in the 1840s, he married, had two children, and eventually moved to Cincinnati, Ohio, where he started a business as an engraver. Then in 1849, he published his own newspaper called the Cincinnati Occasional. And after publishing a few stories about the Franklin Expedition, which was, of course, the hot news of the time, so you had to run some stories about that, uh-huh. whether you liked it or not. But he got obsessed with the story, and suddenly he was a total Franklaholic. He could not get enough of this. He couldn't get enough of stories about polar exploration, and he started dedicating his time to learning everything he could about the Arctic.
I love that he started a newspaper and he called it the Cincinnati Occasional, which is like kind of setting yourself up to be like, you'll get an issue when I get around to it.
When I'm ready.
This ain't the Cincinnati Daily. This ain't the Cincinnati Weekly. It's the Cincinnati Occasional.
Listen, guys, I'm doing this for fun.
Yeah.
It's a hobby. You
this
get it when you get it.
Homemade zine I'm doing. Just really, just setting the bar.
That's so funny because I was thinking the exact same thing. I was like, we should have called our show Occasional. Would really take the pressure off.
By 1857, he had this stack of research all about the Arctic, about any expeditions that went out there, and every piece of info he could find about the Franklin expedition specifically. And he decided, you know what? I'm going to do it. I'm going to go find the survivors of the Franklin expedition. Make way, folks.
And I want to make $2 million.
Right, yeah. Now, bear in mind, Franklin's ships had disappeared over a decade ago at this point, but this wasn't like a crazy endeavor because things moved way more slowly back then. It was so normal to not hear anything from these exploring ships for a very long time that Franklin's mission was gone without any contact with England for 3 years before anyone even started to worry.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that was like, you know, so long, goodbye, we'll hear from you in a decade or so, who knows, you know?
I mean, like, there's not like there's a postal service
right.
or somebody to take, carry a letter back
right,
to England
exactly,
for you.
Right, exactly, exactly. So, and they knew that once you get into that region, everything slows down.
Yeah.
Because sometimes you just have to weigh anchor for months
and
just
wait
for the weather to change. Mm-hmm. And with all that, it also wasn't totally impossible that the crew was stranded and surviving somewhere, either with the Inuit or maybe just on their own, like some kind of Gilligan's Island on ice. Which would have been a much more boring show.
I mean, you know? Gilligan's Island on ice. It would be kind of funny, though, to see this tropical paradise set, but they're all on skates. I don't know. That might be kind of funny.
Well, yeah, that'd be good. Yeah. I don't know about Gilligan's Island with an Arctic setting.
Yeah, no, I don't think that would be as pleasant of a show.
Hey, little buddy. Professor. We're going to have to eat the professor.
Oh, God.
So
you think anyone thought of that? And then they were like, no, we need the girls in bikinis as often
as
possible.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah. I'm going to be like, do you like Marianne or Ginger more? Like, is there a difference? I just see a parka.
Just
walking parkas.
I don't know.
So Hall has got no experience sailing. He's got no experience exploring. He's got no ship, no crew, but he is 100% committed to finding these guys. So,
please give me the confidence I know, of Charles
right?
Francis Hall.
Exactly. And what does someone with no money or experience do to break into the hottest industry of the day? He starts crowdfunding.
Oh, yay!
Set himself up a Kickstarter. He's like, hey, everyone, here's your second update. Thanks to everyone who pitched in so far. I'm going to throw in an enamel pin as a new perk for anyone who decides to give over $100. And if you give over $500, I will send back a signed block of ice.
Oh, a signed block of ice.
After. In a plastic bag.
Right. Guys, I'm adding a stretch goal. I'll send you your own piece of whale blubber.
Mm. Oh, I gotta get that perk.
Might take a few months to get to you, and right. You won't want to eat it when it gets there.
If you haven't received your block of ice or whale blubber in 3 years, then reach out.
So after about 2 years, Hall had crowdsourced a little stack of cash, his primary benefactor being Henry Grinnell, a merchant and philanthropist. And he sold his newspaper, and that was enough for him to get a spot on a whaling ship that was heading out to Cumberland Sound, right near Baffin Island. The ship was called the George Henry, and it was captained by Sidney Buddington. Of course, Charles Hall was a complete amateur. He had very little support on this voyage. But his belief was, you know, if I can live among the Inuit, then anyone could have survived with them. He's like, I'm an idiot. I have no experience.
My paper comes out occasionally. So if I can survive with the Inuit, anyone can.
Yeah, he's like, so his idea was basically like, let me go put myself amongst the Inuit. And if I end up not dying, then I know that I've got a shot at finding the Franklin expedition
exactly. Alive
and well. So in 1860, the George Henry arrived at Baffin Island. Hall hopped off the ship and walked into a coastal Inuit village, which just happened to be the home of Epiervik and Tukulitu. Now in their early 20s, they walked out to meet Charles Hall. And he's like, greetings, I am American. I come in peace. Can you teach me the ways of your people? And they stare at him for a second, and then they're like, yeah, man, sure. Like, come on through. I'll show you where we hang our coats. Like, you want a beer or something? He's like, oh shit.
Boy, is my face red from frostbite.
I was just about to say maybe he was embarrassed, but I'm not getting the impression that this guy gets embarrassed.
No, I don't think Charles Hall knows how to get embarrassed.
Oh, great. I will take a beer. Thank you so much.
I mean, Hall hit the jackpot landing here with Tukulitu and Epiervik because they're totally versed in British culture and you know, a good bit of American culture as well. They speak fluent English, and they've had experience sailing with white explorers. So the two of them hit it off with Hall right away. Also, remember, they're like the friendliest, nicest people in the world at this time, I think.
Yeah.
And they're just like, yes, welcome, please. I love you. They're like immediately just hugs, and they're just like, so nice.
Jokes.
Right. They all go back to their home to get to know each other. And Hall says, you know, probably something like, hey, so how are you all doing? My name's Charles Hall. What are your names? And she says, I'm Tukulitu. And Hall is like, you know what? How about Hannah? What if your name's Hannah?
Tukulitu? That's too hard to say.
And Ipirvik says, well, a lot of people call me Joe, but my name is Ipirvik. And Hall writes down, got it, Joe Ibirbing.
Ibirbing?
He's like, no, I said Ipirvik. He said, yeah, that's what I said, Ibirbing.
Where the fuck did you get a B from, Charles?
Like, or a bing.
Or a bing. What the fuck are you talking about?
So, but that is true. To this day, most of the writings, you'll see them referred to as Hannah and Joe Ibirbing.
Wow.
And they even, I mean, they seemed to like this. I mean, they kind of adopted the names and they even signed their letters, Hannah and Joe, especially, I mean, their letters to other white people. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I mean, you know, I think at the time it was a cute thing for them. They were like, oh, that's cool. We got our own, like, American names. Mm-hmm. That's fun.
Totally, like, yeah. Well, sort of like I took Japanese in high school and we all got to choose our Japanese name.
Yeah, same with French for me, yeah.
Yeah, my friend was like, you should be Sakura because it means little flower. And I thought it was so cute.
Oh, were you Sakura?
It was
like
one of the best compliments I got in high school. Okay. I was like, little flower, me?
We were given a list of names in French class to pick. Oh. And I picked Serge.
Oh.
Specifically because I thought it was funny that it sounded like Surge, which was a hot soda at the time.
What's so funny about you saying that is that I immediately thought of Beverly Hills Cop 3 because Eddie Murphy has a French friend who he calls Serge instead of Serge.
Oh, well, there you go.
And Serge keeps correcting him, of course, and then he goes, Serge. Sounds like a detergent.
I lucked out because with my, you know, last name Banks, so I was early in line to pick names. We just she just went through the list and was like, we all had the same list of names. She went down, everyone tell me what yours is. And I said, Serge. And I heard four other guys go, oh, man.
Damn, I wanted to be Serge.
All right, so Joe and Hannah Ibirbing took him in. They showed Hall their ways. And for 2 years, he lived with the Inuit. And as an avid writer, he documented more about their culture and their lives than any visitor before him. His journals describe their traditions, their oral histories, their language, and details of how they managed to survive for so long in such a seemingly unsurvivable climate.
And yeah, that would be fascinating.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you were describing some of the igloo stuff and shit. I was like, this is...
The igloos are so interesting to me because I'll do a quick side note here. Igloos were not traditionally like their main houses. Mm-hmm. They usually used them as shelter when they were hunting. You know, when they were going to be gone from their village for a while, and you build ice blocks up in an igloo shape, like you're thinking, mm-hmm. and it keeps the wind out and it holds body heat in. And when you're in there at night sleeping, your body heat, you know, fills the igloo and it starts to kind of melt the ice a little bit. And then when you leave in the daytime to go hunt, that ice freezes again and it solidifies the igloo more and more so that the longer you spend in it, the more sturdy and hard the structure gets.
Wow.
So it's brilliant. I mean, the way they come up with these things. You have to drill air holes in your igloo.
Sure.
Cause otherwise
sure.
You'll fill it with carbon dioxide and you
will suffocate yourself.
But they could build fires in these igloos.
That's so cool.
Yeah,
see, I had no
cook.
Idea.
I
literally thought it's just a ice house and it's freezing in there.
Nope.
Like, why would you live like that?
No, it's great. Although I did read that their villages, they usually used whalebone and skins to
sure.
build their more permanent homes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'll also say, just because of Charles Hall's very interesting interpretation of a Ipirvik's name, I'm not sure that I'd really find his language notes to be very very reliable.
He's just like,
but
yeah, it sounded like they said a Ibirbing or
I
something.
Think it's Anyai or something. I don't know. But the longer Charles Francis Hall lived with the Inuit, the more he was convinced that the crew from Franklin's voyage could still be alive. He dressed like the Inuit. He ate their food. He adopted their lifestyle quickly. And he, again, knew if he could do it, anyone could do it.
Mm-hmm.
And during the 2 years that he stayed, Ipirvik and Tukulitu helped him travel and map much of the Frobisher Bay area on the south side of Baffin Island. He found some evidence of British explorers around this area, but all from earlier expeditions in the 16th century, nothing from the Franklin expedition.
I love that he shows up and he's like, oh, all I found was some 300-year-old shit. This is worthless.
Who cares?
Garbage. Throw it back in the water.
So yeah, he needed to get to King William Island, and that was not going to happen on this trip. Meanwhile, Tukulitu and Apeirvik were getting a taste of the difference between American and British whalers.
Right.
Tukulitu once wrote to Charles Hall, quote, "I feel very sorry to say that many of the whaling people are very bad, making the Inuits bad too. They swear very much and make our people swear. I wish they would not do so. Americans swear a great deal. More and worse than the English. I wish no one would swear." Well, fuck, I'm so sorry, Tukulitu.
It's true.
My ass is the one telling this story.
Tukulitu would not.
She would not care for this show.
She was so friendly. Mm-hmm. But she would have been like, damn, that girl, she's so nice, but she swears so much.
She wouldn't have said damn.
That's true, yeah. She would have said darn.
Darn that girl.
That girl is so nice, but she's just got a mouth like a sailor. Then in 1862, Tukulitu and Apeirvik gave birth to their first child, a baby named Taralikitok, and that means butterfly. Hall wrote of him, quote, "I never saw a more animated, sweet-tempered, bright-looking child, likely to be remembered by all who ever saw him." Hall invited Tukulitu and Apeirvik, along with their newborn son, to go back with him to the States to raise money for his next expedition. And they'd become good friends at this point, and because of Hall's infectious enthusiasm, the two of them were pretty much getting super invested in finding the Franklin expedition, too. And they got back to the States, and just like in England, they were brought to exhibitions. And this included Barnum's American Museum in New York City, run by P.T. Barnum. And they were advertised as the, quote, "first and only inhabitants of these frozen regions ever brought to the United States." And of course, it was sensationalized and totally inaccurate.
What?
And probably pretty racist.
No way.
In
fact, P.T. Barnum.
Right. And in fact, Hall did stop bringing them to these big exhibitions because there wasn't money up front. It was a little too sensational. And he was worried about their health. It says in some sources. So he stopped doing those big extravagant expeditions and instead took them on this like lecture tour of the East Coast with him.
That's probably, yeah, you could control a lot more about a lecture tour than you can.
Yeah, and
exhibition.
Probably take more of the money for yourself.
Absolutely.
I think was a big part
you
of it.
You could probably name your price.
Right. But in terms of the Barnum exhibit, they had to be there 3 times a day for 2 hours each time every day of the week. Mm-hmm. So it was like a noon to 2, 4 to 6, and 7 to 9 kind of thing.
Okay.
They had to do 3 times a day. People paid 25 cents to get in, which is only about $8 today. And then, of course, they switched over to this lecture tour.
Yeah.
And when they weren't on the road doing that, the Inuit family stayed with Captain Sidney Buddington in Groton, Connecticut. And they totally fell in love with this town. Tukulitu became especially good friends with Mrs. Buddington, and she referred to her as her pretty mother.
Hmm.
Soon, Tukulitu was like a celebrity within the Buddington circle of friends, and they all said that she was, quote, "full of frolicsome and comical ways."
Except for the swearing, I think I could totally hang out with Tukulitu.
Oh, right? Yeah.
I'd have to really work on curbing the tongue.
Look, you do good with kids mostly.
Mostly.
Yeah.
Except when I slip up, I'll go, fuck. I'll be like, damn, kid. Oh, shit. Fuck. It just gets worse and worse.
It's all that time on the whaling ship you spent.
I know. These sailors, you know.
Yeah.
So Tukulitu, Apeirvik, and Taralikitok toured the East Coast with Hall as he gave lectures and raised money, but it took a real toll on all three of them. Buddington told Hall he wanted to bring them back up north on his next trip out of concern for their health, but Hall fought with him about it. He said it was unnecessary. And then sadly, in the spring of 1863, Taralikitok, who was still an infant, died of pneumonia in New York. Hmm. And he was buried in Groton, Connecticut, not far from the Buddingtons' home where they had been staying. And Tukulitu was, understandably, inconsolable.
Yeah.
And it suggested she was even suicidal. But eventually, she regained her health. And the next year, in 1864, they went with Hall on his next expedition to King William Island. They toured Rose Welcome Sound, trying to find Inuit guides who were more familiar with the islands in this area, but they weren't nearly as willing to help him travel as Apeirvik and Tukulitu were. But the two of them helped him communicate, and he started to learn more about the Franklin Expedition crew who had come through there nearly 20 years earlier at this point. But it was difficult to return to the ice. Tukulitu was missing the warm years they'd spent with the Buddingtons in Connecticut. In July of 1864, Tukulitu wrote a letter to them saying, quote, "Mrs. Buddington, how are you? I've been sick, 3 or 4 day. I like to come see my pretty mother during this time. Homesick. Joe lame, back and leg. Sometime he can't rest in night. I sorry for him. I think of him every day. Sometime better, sometime very hard time."
I love that. I love that. I think that's one of the clearest examples of how they felt about each other, too.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they were really close. I think it's interesting that, you know, I read that they don't necessarily marry by choice or marry out of love. They said it did happen sometimes, but because there were so few people,
right,
it wasn't like you had a lot of options.
Right.
But I think that those bonds must have formed just out of adaptation, you know? Like, you had to really care about everyone because you were all like a single thing living up there, you know? Like, you're almost, these villages, almost a single organism in terms of how close and connected everyone was. And if one person doesn't do well, or if you didn't like somebody, that could ruin it for everyone.
That's true.
But and then seeing them together on these trips, it's, I thought it was nice to read this and hear her say, like, "I think of him every day. I'm really sorry for him."
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah,
it's kind of sweet.
Yeah. Well, you do see that with arranged marriages
all
the time.
Oh, yeah,
that love does form and grow over the years.
Yeah.
And especially in their case, you know, they're being brought together and kept together by some extreme circumstances,
right,
not only in their regular life, but also with all these expeditions and, like, going out there being the only two Inuit people around. I'm sure they became a great comfort to each other.
Yeah.
Then they lost a child together,
which
can either bind you or separate you,
I think.
But I think in this case, they probably were really clinging to each other for a lot of comfort in a strange place. A few years later, into this journey to King William Island, Ipirvik and Tukulitu had another baby who also died in infancy after a long, difficult sledding trip.
Yeah.
A little bit of tragedy, a lot of tragedy
for
them
in
the family.
Hard time. Yeah.
In the family way.
Definitely, definitely. It's just those, I couldn't speak to how common that was or anything, but I imagine those conditions, it's got to be hard to
Keep a baby alive.
I mean,
insane.
Yeah. Because especially on these expeditions where they're like, well, we might just end up having to sit here in the snow for 6 months.
Right.
Or we might have to take this sledding trip 1,000 miles, you know, into the ice.
And you don't know what's there.
You don't know what's there.
You can assume, but you don't know.
Right. You're literally going to find out.
It's sort of like how it was going around the internet, got viral for a minute a couple years ago about how women in Iceland will, like, leave their babies bundled up in a stroller, but they'll leave them outside, like, a coffee shop or something while they go in and have a drink.
Yep.
And people are like, what? This is insane!
Whatever.
But of course, in Iceland, or where, I think I'm guessing Iceland, but they were kind of like, well, you have to get them used to the cold. I mean, this is where they live, you know? Like, they need to be feeling warm in Groton, Connecticut.
Right. Yeah, so this whole expedition took a whole 5 years. And in 1868, which is about 4 years into it, they had a huge argument which broke out between much of the crew and Charles Hall. And he ended up shooting and killing a man named Patrick Coleman. Now, because Hall claimed that they were trying to mutiny, he never faced charges for it. I can't imagine that made things less awkward for the trip home.
No.
But somehow they pressed on. And when they finally reached King William Island, Hall finally found some of the crew from Franklin's expedition.
Hey.
So all his work had paid off. He was like, oh, you're here. Except there's one little problem. They were skeletons.
Oh.
So he couldn't exactly ask them what happened.
Nope.
And with no survivors discovered and very little evidence as to what did happen to them, their expedition was at an end. They were not going to find the Franklin. It was time to go home. And so they packed up and set sail back for the States. On their way back, the ship stopped at an Inuit settlement called Igloolik, which means there is a house here, which I think is a great name
for
a town.
There is a house here.
That's like the town I grew up in upstate New York. It's like, there is a house here.
We swear.
don't blink or you'll miss it. And in Igloolik, they met with another Inuit couple named Tilikum and Pukining. who had a 2-year-old daughter named Isagaituk. And it's not clear why the couple was willing to do this, but at Hall's suggestion, Tukulitu and Epirvik adopted their little girl. Apparently, initially, the mother was super into it, and the father was resistant, but Hall gave them a sled in exchange, which was a pretty, it must have been a nice sled.
I
pretty
guess
good deal. Because
so.
They were both like, all right, no, this sounds like a good idea. And
weird.
Yeah, it's strange.
That's weird.
I think he was just like, these guys need a kid. They've been through a lot
through
and
a
they
lot.
Need a kid. And I think maybe, speculation station, maybe this couple didn't want or was having a hard time with a kid or something.
Right.
For whatever reason, they were willing to do it. And so they adopted this girl and they called her Panic, which is simply Inuktitut for daughter. Now, Hall, of course, had to do his thing and give her an American name, which was Sylvia Grinnell Ibirbing, named after his benefactor, Henry Grinnell.
Uh-huh.
So he was like, well, she gets an American name too, and I'm going to throw Henry's name in there because he keeps giving me money.
He pays the bills.
They returned to Groton, Connecticut in 1869, and this all-American family, Hannah, Joe, and Sylvia, bought a 2-story house for $300.
Oh.
Which is about, let me see.
Calculating transfer rate.
$6,100 today.
Wow.
And just for reference, the median home price in Groton right now is $315,000. So pretty good deal in the long run. And in Groton, Joe worked as a carpenter and Hannah as a seamstress. And they hoped to settle down and live a nice, warm Connecticut life together. But 2 years later, in 1871, adventure called once again. After the Civil War ended, the American government got very interested in the global race to the North Pole. And with Henry Grinnell's support, Charles Francis Hall caught the attention of President Grant, who named him a man with survival skills but no academic background in traveling and no experience leading men or commanding a ship, the commander of the ship.
Oh,
great idea. And when we come back, we'll join them on their most dangerous, harrowing, ridiculous voyage yet. An absolutely catastrophic journey full of ice, snow, and murder. So bundle up and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the show.
So everyone's trying to be the first to the North Pole. It's the space race of the day, right? And America thought this guy, who did have a ton of experience sailing in the Arctic and certainly never shut up about it, should be the one to do it, right? It was
right.
All over the Cincinnati Occasional every once in a while.
Occasionally, it was talked about.
So the ship and the expedition were both named the Polaris. And, of course, because Hall had no sailing experience and he knew it, he knew he was going to have to be super selective in choosing his officers and his crew. He mostly hired whalers who were experienced with sailing Arctic waters. And these were salty, gruff sailors who had a different kind of discipline than the British vessels who used mostly military crews for these kind of voyages. So he's like, you know, he's probably smart in terms of who he's picking for being able to navigate these waters.
Right.
But also, these were not guys who were easy to control.
Sure.
They were not trained, like, disciplined sailor types. They were like, I do what I want because that's how we survive. Like Teamsters, you know? Like,
yeah.
They were like, this is how it's done, boss. But for his sailing master, of course, he knew he had to get Sidney Buddington, who had been captain on the George Henry back in his earlier voyages. Even though they had fought a whole lot in the past and didn't seem to actually like each other very much, he knew that, like, Sidney's my boy. That guy's going to be able to do a good job. This guy knows what it's like to sail up there. So he picked him. And Buddington, however, was like, oh, God, no, please, please, no, don't make me go with
I don't want to go.
Don't make me go with this guy again. But when another one of his contracts fell through, he had to say yes. I'll do it. In the time that Buddington wasn't going after he turned him down, Charles Hall asked another guy named George Emery Tyson to do it, who also said no.
Oh.
But then Sidney came back and said yes, and then Tyson came back and said yes.
Oops.
So now Hall's asked a few too many questions. He's made a few too many offers. And so to make up for this, he just makes up his position for Tyson, and he calls him the assistant navigator. And basically what this meant was that this ship had three people who thought they were in charge.
Terrible, terrible idea. So Apeirvik and Tukulitu couldn't turn down Hall for this trip, but they brought their adopted daughter Panic along with them. And they left in June 1871 and immediately had problems.
Yep.
Before they even left the Brooklyn Navy Yard, the cook, a fireman, and an assistant engineer deserted the ship.
Oh.
They were like, wait, where are we going? never mind.
I distinctly heard you say Nassau in the Caribbean.
I thought we were going to the Caribbean. And the ship steward was immediately discovered to be a drunk and was left behind.
Oh, my God.
The doctor, a German named Emil Bessels, thought Hall shouldn't be in charge at all.
Mm.
And Tyson, the assistant navigator, wrote in his diary that a lot of the crew didn't like Charles Hall. And, quote, already some have made up their minds how far they will go and when they will get home again.
Oof.
So they were like, I mean, I'm along for as long as I feel like being here. You don't tell me what to do. So it was just a messy bunch all around. Like, nobody on this. I bet Tukulitu and Apeirvik were like, do y'all not know about the community thing? Like,
y'all
not familiar with how we all have to live together?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And about the only people on Hall's side were Tukulitu and Apeirvik.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody else kind of just saw him as this micromanaging jerk.
Right. But Tukulitu and Apeirvik were old friends of his.
Right.
And of course, they just saw the good in everyone.
Right.
Like you said, they were more about like, well, yeah, but we all have to get along.
Right.
There's a community here.
Why would I focus on your worst qualities when I'm supposed to live next to you for the rest of my life?
I mean,
let me find what's good about you and focus on that.
Yep.
I guess that makes sense.
So nevertheless, they pressed on, and in early September, they crossed the Robeson Canal and set a new record, 82 degrees, 11 minutes north. Now, no white man had ever been closer to the North Pole at this point.
Ooh.
So they're really feeling good about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They really made it far. At this point, the three commanders started to argue about what to do next. Hall and Tyson agreed that they should sail further north to minimize the amount of time they would have to spend sledding. But Buddington thought that was too risky for the ship. They should anchor here and start sledding north from here. In the end, Hall and Tyson won out. But as they sailed north and winter got worse, they were forced to anchor the ship, which was exactly what Buddington was trying to avoid.
Mm-hmm.
They ended up in a place called Thank God Harbor.
Whoever named it was like, thank God there's a harbor here.
Yeah, right. At this point, Hall decided that he was going to go ahead on foot, kind of scout out the area ahead, see if they could sled up to the North Pole from here. And he would have taken Tyson with him. They were getting along better than anyone in Buddington at this point. But he told Tyson, quote, I cannot trust Buddington alone with the ship.
Hmm.
So he asked him to stay behind and keep an eye on him. Literally, maybe Buddington will turn and leave while we're gone, or maybe he'll just, you know, screw everything up. Because Buddington may have been an alcoholic. There's some evidence in the crew's testimony afterwards that he was stealing liquor from the ship's stores, including alcohol from the science lab that they were using to preserve specimens.
Ooh.
So that's the sign of a serious alcoholic when you're,
when you're drinking
rubbing alcohol.
Rubbing
alcohol.
Yeah.
Aldehyde. That's
really bad.
Yeah.
Although it makes me think this ship steward must have been really bad drunk if they realized it before they even left and they had this guy in charge.
Uh-huh.
Maybe Buddington was like, listen, it takes one to know one. Get that guy out of here. He's an elbow crooker. So Hall took two sleds, his first mate, Chester, Apeirvik, and another Inuit guide named Hendrik, and they left on October 10th for the sledding expedition to see if they could make it to the North Pole.
Uh-huh.
And Tukulitu stayed behind to take care of their child, Panic. Hall sent Hendrik back on day two with a bunch of instructions for the rest of the guys.
Uh-huh.
For example, he told the doctor, who was a scientist with 3 degrees, don't forget to wind the clock. And he left Buddington, who is a sailing master with over 2 decades of experience, a lengthy to-do list while he was away. And this was the kind of micromanaging that made everybody hate him.
Seriously.
So if you're a manager, remember Charles Hall and don't be like that.
Oh, my God. I love that he, like, that they left. And 2 days later, he was like, you know what? You know what? I got something to say to these guys. He's been thinking about it this whole time. I should have left them something to do. What are they going to get up to while I'm gone? Not work, that's for sure.
Not work. So they were gone for 2 full weeks. And when they came back, they had a nice cup of coffee.
Mm.
And Apeirvik took his to his room to drink. But at 10 p.m., Tukulitu came to get Epirvik and told him that Hall was very sick and vomiting. And he wouldn't let anyone see him except Tukulitu. He was convinced someone on the ship had poisoned him. And Tukulitu told him, you know, why don't you go see the German doctor who's sitting right here, Emil Bessels. But Hall was like, that's probably the guy who tried to kill me. So no, I'd like to not see him.
And for a few days, he was terribly sick. Just vomiting and feeling weak and tired and aching and his left side all hurt. It was crazy. But he started to improve a couple days later. He was getting better. He was back on his feet. And on November 4th, he was able to go above board. And finally, he relented. One of the other officers convinced him, like, you've got to go see Bessels. He's our doctor. You're sick. Like, can we just forget about all this and you go talk to the doctor? And he says, all right, I'll do it. And then suddenly, after seeing Bessels, he started to get sick again. A few grueling days later, Charles Hall vomited, collapsed, and died. Now, Bessels' diagnosis was apoplexy, which is a dated term they don't use anymore that meant like a ruptured organ or a stroke. They took him ashore and they had a formal burial. But the mission wasn't over. They needed to press on. But now, Buddington was in charge, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, things got way worse.
No! Oh, no!
Morale and discipline totally diminished. Buddington was drunk all the time, although Tyson started to drink a lot more, too. And one of the crewmates even stole and made a copy of Buddington's key so that they could all steal liquor from the stores.
Oh, my God. Do you think at any point anyone opened the stores and were like, there's no fucking liquor in here?
They must have brought so much to have several drunks and the whole crew stealing. There must have been a lot of booze when they left.
Seriously.
I mean, that's, you know, when you're picking out your provisions.
That's the number one thing.
At some point, we're going to have to sit in the snow for 6 months.
Mm-hmm. What are we
going to
do?
More rum, please. So there was no set bedtime. Everyone was just doing as they pleased. Mm. It was total chaos. And then Buddington decided to start handing out firearms to everyone.
What?
Nobody knows why. It was just like, well, we're all getting drunk, so have a gun. You get a gun. You get a gun.
Well, let's add freaking weapons to this chaos.
Just total nonsense going on in this ship.
In January, Tyson wrote in his diary, quote, last month, such an astonishing proposition was made to me that I have never ceased thinking of it since. Enough to make Captain Hall stir in his ice-cold grave.
Ooh.
Yeesh. He wrote that he and the first mate agreed that the proposition was monstrous and unthinkable, and he never said specifically what they were talking about, but Canadian writer Farley Mowat suggested that the proposition they're talking about was that they should fake the rest of their journey to the North Pole and just pretend they had made it.
That's so, I mean, like, yeah, for someone whose job this is, you can imagine that is like the craziest thing anyone has ever said to you.
Yeah.
You want us to just go back and lie about it and have the whole world like hail us as heroes for something we never did.
Yeah.
That sounds like a nightmare. I mean, I wouldn't be able to sleep at night, you know?
Right. Well, and at this time, you know, there were lots of guys that had this, like, sense of honor.
Right.
Where it was like, oh, you know, I could colonize and kill an entire coast's worth of people. But if I cheat at cards, I'm a real asshole. Like, you know what I mean? I would never do something so terrible. So I agree. I'm sure he really did think, like, to go back and, as you say, I didn't think about that. To be hailed as heroes for something you never did
would
certainly be really uncomfortable.
No, that would weigh on you.
I don't care if you were a normal person.
Right.
Well, they chilled out until June, until some of the men sat out in a smaller boat to try and get to the pole. But the boat was crushed by ice, and they were forced to walk back to the ship.
Jeez.
Another mini team set out, but within days, Buddington got cold feet and sent Epirvik to bring them back.
Man.
And so they had to abandon their boats and walk back to the Polaris once again, and now they were short 4 lifeboats.
God.
So the Polaris mission was over.
Yeah. They were like, we're done with
this
mess.
This is a hot mess.
We are not going to get to the North Pole.
This is not even a hot mess. It's a cold mess.
I guess at this point, they were just like, Buddington already was like, I'm done with this. I'm going home. We're out of booze. I'm getting out of here.
Tyson was like, he hasn't got the bottom for this voyage.
Tyson was pretty bummed out about this. He really, I think, wanted to go on and finish. He wrote, quote, "What opportunities have been lost?" And there's longer quotes about how he's just like, this sucks. Somebody's going to get to the North Pole at some point, and I'm going to be mad that people got in my way and it couldn't have been me.
Well, and they were already all the way up there and had already gone through all this stuff. I'm sure he's like a little bit of sunk cost fallacy where he's like, no, I have to make it. I'm so close.
Seriously. So they turned around. They started to head south back to the States. But in October, Buddington ran the ship into an icy sandbar and they started taking on water.
You think he was drunk commanding?
Quite possible. I mean, almost definitely.
Drunk sailing.
He starts ordering cargo to be thrown overboard so that they wouldn't, you know, sink, so they could lighten the ship, balance things out, and buoy the ship. But because they sucked so bad at discipline and order, and there was no clear chain of command, everything was just chaos, and they're just throwing stuff overboard with no one telling them where or how to throw it. Mm-hmm. So they ended up losing a ton of cargo. Like, everything they jettisoned, basically, it was never seen again. Meanwhile, Ipirvik, Tukulitu, Panic, Hendrik, Tyson, and 15 other crew members were all out on the surrounding ice at night. They had told everyone, like, it's not safe on the ship, so let's all just go hang out on the ice until we know things are good, and then we'll bring you back on board. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, the ground started to break. The ice cracked and split, and soon, the 19 people on that ice floe were floating away from the Polaris.
Oh, terrifying. I cannot imagine a more scary thing than be on a freaking piece of ice floating through a frozen sea.
Away from your ship.
Oh my God, terrifying.
Although,
like, a nightmare.
I don't know.
Nightmare.
I wonder if Tyson, speculation station, maybe if I'm Tyson, I'm like, you know what? That's this true. Is better.
Wait, are Tukulitu and Ipirvik here? Okay.
Oh, we're good.
This is better.
Right? Seriously. I just keep thinking of Yukon Cornelius and Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer when they're running from the abominable snowman.
Oh,
and they he chops the ice up and they float away on that.
Yes.
Not as cute.
Just not as cute. But, way less claymation.
But they drifted over 1,800 miles for 6 months.
Oh my God.
And it is universally agreed that if Ipirvik and Tukulitu, as well as Hendrik, hadn't been with them, everyone would have died.
I definitely would have thought that.
Yeah, because the sailors were, again, just terribly undisciplined. They went through their food rations like crazy. They even had a night where they just went hog wild and started feasting, just stuffing their faces with their rations because they just couldn't take it anymore.
They were like, what I really want is to become a cannibal, so let's get rid of all this food.
Yeah, can't wait to eat a person. They're like, it's day 3, and they're like, I can't take it anymore. And not only that, but they actually had some lifeboats with them, but they were confused about where they were. They thought they were on one side of Greenland, but they were actually on the other side. So they kept expecting to see land come up, but they didn't. I don't know if they were just looking in the wrong direction or what, but they decided that the lifeboats were useless to them, and they broke them up for firewood.
No, what?
Yeah.
Oh my God, they're so dumb.
So they are not handling this well. Nobody's listening to Tyson. He tries to take command, and everyone just does whatever they want, so he basically gives up. Meanwhile, Ipirvik and Hendrik start hunting seal, and they're on the middle of this chunk of ice in the Arctic Ocean with like nothing around them. They start bringing in seal for everyone to eat. And Tukulitu builds igloos so they have somewhere to get away from the wind and the cold and save their body heat.
Wow.
So these guys just start working for these lazy asses and start collecting up and start just making sure everyone's going to survive.
Right.
All in all, I mean, it sounds like a pretty nice cruise, you know?
Oh, I guess it's on par with that Carnival cruise where everybody
got covered
in shit.
Where the toilets exploded. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Which would you rather be out in the middle of the ocean, freezing for 6 months, eating nothing but seal in an igloo, or 6 weeks on the Carnival cruise covered in shit?
That's a game show right there. That's a tough one. A real Sophie's choice.
Oof.
They were picked up in April of 1873 on the coast of Newfoundland by a whaling ship, and their Inuit guides were hailed as heroes, which obviously they were because everyone would be dead without them. Meanwhile, Buddington had gotten the Polaris moving again. But they'd burned too much coal without any discipline during the voyage, and soon he had to run the ship aground. And since they'd lost so much of their ship when he had them throw it overboard, they really didn't have the supplies they needed to survive another winter. So they pulled lumber from the ship and built shelters. And there were 14 of them huddled together with few survivor skills among them, very little food, near death, when suddenly, lo and behold, the Eta Inuit showed up and helped them survive through the winter.
Oh, my God.
Man, Inuits are the real heroes of this whole story
if
throughout.
You're stranded in the Arctic, you better hope some Inuit show up okay. to help you out because
you will
that's
die.
The only him. Way these people lived.
And in June of 73, they built ships from salvaged wood and sailed south and were eventually rescued by a whaling ship in July.
So the 19 people from the ice floe get back to the States.
Mm-hmm.
And the U.S. Navy is like, hey, what the hell happened out there?
This looks like a shitty
mess. What in the frozen hell happened? You're like, where's your captain?
Uh-huh.
I'm sorry, where's your ship,
uh-huh.
by the way? You didn't get to the North Pole, I'm guessing.
Mm-hmm. Where's the rest of your people, period?
Yeah. They brought back more questions than answers.
Or people.
Right, or people. They
or
brought
ships.
Back more questions than people, boats, anything. So the U.S. Navy opened a formal inquiry, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
This was a lot of money went into this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at this time, Buddington and his people hadn't even been rescued yet. No one knew what happened to the Polaris at this point.
Oh.
They asked Tukulitu, and she had actually said, oh, they're good. They parked somewhere safe. If they wait till the summer, then they'll be able to sail out no problem, which, of course, Buddington was not able to do. But
no. She
thought it should be no problem for them. So they're kind of waiting for them to show back up.
She had a lot of faith.
She was such an optimist.
What a sweet
she
angel.
Really is. So they bring Tyson in to give his sort of testimony about what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, basically, Buddington sucks. And we think the doctor might have poisoned Charles Hall. Like, that's probably something that happened, apparently. So they decide they want to talk to everybody.
Sure.
And they bring in Epirvik and Tukulitu as well, who, again, were considered heroes of this trip.
Right.
And they get their testimony. Epirvik laid it out. He said, quote, didn't like Buddington. Always talking behind back. Hall told me when sick, somebody give him something bad. He was sick 2 weeks. Buddington did not take care of him. I think it not right. Made me feel bad. He say something bad in coffee I drink last night, making me sick and stomach bad.
Mm.
And then he said in the few days where Hall felt better, that Hall was looking through the doctor's medicinal books, and he pointed to something and told Epirvik, that thing is making me sick. And Epirvik didn't know what it was specifically, but he said in his deposition, quote, something about poison, I think.
And Tukulitu gave testimony to their experience on the ice floe. She said she was taking her stuff off the ship after the big leak, and a fireman had told her the ship was going to be okay. But Buddington told her to ignore that and just take her stuff and her daughter and go out on the ice where it's safe. And then the ice broke up.
Oh, God. Never listen
Buddington.
To Buddington.
Okay.
He was right that one time.
That's true.
So it's, I mean, none of them were ever right very often. That's the problem.
And they asked Tukulitu who was in command on the ice floe, and she said, nobody. Which definitely sounds accurate.
Yeah.
And they asked, you know, what about Tyson? Because he's this assistant navigator dude
uh-huh.
or whatever. And she said, quote, well, he could not control them. He tried to do everything he could. He's a good man. We have known him a good many years. He tried to do everything for the best. I sorry, and Joe very sorry too. Sometime little provisions left. And she tells a story about how they thought they were about to starve, but a bear showed up across the ice, killed a seal, and while the sailors lay down and tried to stay hidden, Epirvik chased the bear off and took the seal meat for everyone else.
Oh my God.
He chased a bear.
And we must assume that this was a polar bear. Which, if you recall from our last couple episodes, if it's white, good night.
Good night.
You're not. So everybody is, I'm sure he told everyone else, okay, you all lay down, stay quiet. Mm-hmm. I'll take care of this bear. And just went, I don't know, whatever he did. No bear, you can't have your food. We're taking it. Like, that's not a conversation you have with a polar bear.
No, not at all. Oh my God. And also, like, she's apologizing.
Oh my God.
For what?
She's, well, because there wasn't more food, you know, or whatever.
Oh, right.
Like, I'm so sorry there wasn't always a lot
so
of food.
Sorry that we only caught
she's
seals
so...
with zero bait and fucking chased bears off this ice floe for you.
She's so sweet. I can't stand it.
I love it.
She's the best. And through all this testimony and in interviews later, it's the same thing. Authors and historians keep pointing out that Ipirvik and Tukulitu just refused to have a bad attitude about anything.
Mm.
They, like, kind of grumbled about Buddington, but they didn't want to ever say anything outright bad about anybody. Even the lazy sailors on the ice floe, who they basically had to hand feed the whole time they were out there. Like, let me chew up this seal and spit it in your mouth for you.
Spit it in your mouth, baby.
Even them, Ipirvik was like, oh, they're good guys. Offered me a cigar once.
The bar is low.
Seriously.
Is all I have to say. Like, what? They offered me a cigar once. I kept them alive for 6 months, and they offered me a cigar one time.
I mean, like we said, Tukulitu apologized for there not being enough food. I think it speaks to how they were so loyal to Hall as well, because this guy, I mean, it really seemed like he exploited them in the States,
right,
taking them on this lecture tour. I don't think he had bad wishes for them, or they didn't care about them necessarily, but
it
he was definitely
malicious,
but he was definitely using them.
Mm-hmm.
And they were always just like, oh, he's a good friend of ours. He's a good guy. He means well. He's trying his best.
Wow.
You know, they're super optimistic, which, like we said, you must to be.
You got to bring your own sunshine to the damn, the damn Arctic, okay?
You do not have time for a bad attitude in the mm-hmm. Arctic. That's going to get everybody in trouble.
I mean, we could all learn a little bit from Tukulitu
seriously.
And Ipirvik and bring a little bit of that energy into our everyday lives.
In all honesty, I'm saying, like, sometimes it's not like if you have comforts and you have stability and security that you can't be upset, mm-hmm. that things can't bother you, that you can't be angry or anything like that. But I do try to remind myself that I'm not living on a sheet of ice. You know, that your outlook, your attitude towards your community, towards other people around you who are just trying to survive with you matters a lot. And I think we have a lot of cynicism and negativity that is very infectious, right? And if you imagine yourself in a smaller community like that, 30, 40 people living in a village in the middle of the harshest conditions on Earth,
right?
And you learn that, like, that negativity really is toxic. Like, it spreads and it hurts and it doesn't do anything to help us.
Mm-hmm.
So if your attitude isn't also contributing to our survival, then check it.
Get rid of it. Yeah.
Lose it. And it's not that easy. I also believe that, you know, emotions are real and
right.
We have to, you know, go by them sometimes. But it's just something to keep in mind.
Yeah. I mean, it is. There is such a thing as toxic positivity and, you know,
yeah.
But I do agree with you that a soupçon of Tukulitu and Ipirvik, it could not go wrong in all of our stews. Well, in the end, there was not enough evidence for any charges to be filed in Hall's death.
Mm.
The final report said, quote, "We are of the opinion that Captain Hall died from natural causes and that the treatment of the case by Dr. Bessels was the best practice under the circumstances."
Okay.
But in 1968, Charles Francis Hall's biographer, Chauncey Chester Loomis Jr., took an expedition of his own to exhume Hall's body. And he was remarkably well-preserved for being dead 200 years because of all the ice you
need. Yeah, right. Packed him in ice.
I mean, that's sort of what it does.
I'm amazed they didn't, like, thaw him out and he's like Encino Man. Like, whoa, the world has changed, dudes.
That would be dope.
I wish.
I love Encino Man.
Let's make that movie.
For real. And testing of his exhumed body showed that he died from arsenic poisoning.
Oh, shit.
Although it must be said that a lot of medicines contained arsenic back then. So it's possible that he even accidentally poisoned himself. So we're still not sure if it's like a malicious poisoning or not. Certainly he was poisoned. Just who did it? Why?
Yeah.
It's up in the air. Although I think I'm still personally prosecuting Dr. Emil Bessels in my head. Because in another twist, it turns out Bessels and Hall were both into the same girl back in New York City. Her name was Vinnie Rehm, and she was a famous sculptor.
Yeah.
And Bessels was more into her than Charles Francis Hall was, but she was more into Hall than Bessels. So there's a whole love triangle going on.
That is a prime recipe for a poisoning.
Oh, yeah. Right, Bessels was like, I see a great opportunity to clear the field for myself.
If there was any more information than just that, this would be a whole episode for us.
I know. That's a little bonus romance because there's not any more.
Right, right.
That was a good one. So, yeah, that's just another possible motive for the sociopath Dr. Emil Bessels.
Right.
Just kidding. It remains unproven. Bessels was never charged. Right. We don't know. Speculation station is a sociopath.
He wasn't charged there, but here on Ridiculous Romance, in the safety of Speculation Station, we're going to say he did it.
He definitely did it.
He murdered Charles Hall.
He was going for love.
So Epirvik, Tukulitu, and Panic returned to Connecticut. Mm-hmm. But Panic's health had been poor ever since the 6 months they spent on the ice floe, understandably. So she did go to school, but in early 1875, she caught pneumonia. And in March of that year, she died at just 9 years old.
No.
I know. Tukulitu fell into declining health after that. And in December of 1876, she died at 38 years old.
Oh, man.
I know. It was just so tough for her trying to raise a family. They never had much luck with that. But she cared about those kids so much.
Mm-hmm.
They were all buried together. Tukulitu was buried right there in Groton beside her children, Panic and Tarlikitok. And Epirvik was heartbroken after Tukulitu's death, of course, and he vowed to return to the North. In 1880, he joined Frederick Schwatka's expedition in search of records of the Franklin expedition. So once again, going back to his roots, this Franklin expedition really defined his life, you know?
And people were so interested like decades and decades.
I feel like it was like the Titanic of their day.
Right. Or maybe like the Donner Party type thing where they just disappeared and you're like, what happened?
Right.
Like we still are asking that all the time.
Yeah, for sure. That voyage wasn't very successful. They didn't end up turning up very much. And when they decided it was over, Epirvik decided that he was going to stay in the North. And there he remarried. And it's unknown exactly when, but it appears that he died just a few years later after that.
And Epirvik was described by American journalist Januarius McGann as, quote, one of the most interesting and pleasant characters he has ever met.
Yeah.
Abirbing Bay in Canada and Joe Island in Greenland are both named after him, and the Tukulitu Inlet in Nunavut and Hannah Island in Greenland are both named for her. And in 1981, Canada named Tukulitu and Epirvik persons of national historic significance for their contributions to exploration, cultural insight, and saving the lives of those on the ice floe.
You're damn right, Canada.
You're damn right.
Historical significance indeed.
I mean, for real, these two were awesome.
I mean,
I'm
love
so
them.
Sad about them never getting to grow a
I
family because it's clear they really wanted one.
Yeah.
But they really did some, I mean, you could say she was sort of mother to all of these nasty sailors.
you could, but I don't think she'd say that.
She's like, I'm good.
They're very nice boys.
They're nice
They're
boys,
not mine.
They ain't mine. I don't know them.
Yeah. They really are amazing. I will say they lived full lives,
yes.
short lives,
short
but
full.
I think they did and saw more mm-hmm. in their, 40-ish years here than most of us will in 80 or 100, you know.
Yeah, that's very true.
Which is a small comfort, but still amazing. I love that they had these lives, that they saw so much, that they had such a tie to their home mm-hmm. and it mattered to them, but they also got to live in completely different places.
Yeah.
And have all these like cultural mashup of experiences, mm-hmm. Which I think is so cool that they were able to kind of retain themselves, but also adapt make all these friends with mm-hmm. all these Americans and stuff. Like, what a life.
And clearly they were both just so awesome and charming. Like,
yes.
Like, she was full of fun and laughter, and he's, like, pleasant and interesting and, like, observant and
yeah.
shit. So they probably were just so much fun to be around.
For real.
So when they're, like, in a Inuit village of 30 people to Groton, Connecticut, to
uh-huh.
freaking London, where there's probably more people they've ever seen in their lives,
uh-huh.
and then they go around all around, you know, the East Coast on some lecture tour and see all these people, that, you know, it's just as much of a community to them
yeah.
as their own tribe
yeah.
back home, which I think is a really lovely way to look at the world.
Yeah, definitely.
So I feel like I learned a lot from Tukulitu and Apeirvik.
I think so, too.
About how to view things and people.
Absolutely. Like, I think, like we were saying, like, it's the kind of comparative nature of your surroundings.
Mm.
Like, what you've seen before and what you're seeing now are so important. Like, you know, they could be having a rough day in Groton, Connecticut.
Yeah.
And be like, well, what was a rough day in on Baffin Island? This is pretty nice.
Yeah. yeah. This is in comparison to that. Pretty nice.
But just such a, I don't know, just two very bright lights, two very
yeah.
uplifting people.
Yeah.
I love them.
Plus, it's such a cool era of history when everyone was so interested in the polar ice, like, expeditions and all this stuff. Just the era of exploration in general is so fascinating.
Love it.
Yeah.
And I so wish it wasn't so clouded with colonialism, you know,
yeah.
and imperialism, because that's obviously the downside of it all.
Mm-hmm. But speaking from, you know, the 21st century comforts I'm very used to, it mm-hmm. seems so weird to me and alien an idea to be like, let me go put myself in the most extreme conditions on the
yeah.
planet that I can find.
Yeah.
Because I just want to know what's there
mm-hmm.
and see if I can do it or whatever. Like, I can't imagine being like, especially back then when they had very few ways to heat themselves
right.
or wrap themselves
right.
up or anything like that. Like, to choose negative degrees
yeah.
is so crazy to me. But,
yeah.
of course, I'm from Georgia where we rarely go under 30. Well, so
right, right. But, yeah, I wonder about the people who settled there,
mm-hmm.
who moved and moved across. You know, I read somewhere that the Inuit may have come originally from Mongolian travelers
mm-hmm.
Up across the Bering Strait into Canada. I could be wrong about that, but that's something I read. But in either case, getting to Baffin Island, at some point,
mm-hmm.
somebody got to Baffin Island and said, yeah, this is good. I'll stop here. And stayed.
Yeah, this is good.
Probably doesn't get any better than this.
Do you think someone next to him was like, you sure? This is good.
I feel like the further that way we walk,
yeah.
the warmer it gets. Maybe we should keep going.
Is it though?
Nah.
It's like Thor face. Is it though?
We're good. Look, we got fish. We got ice. What else is there?
What else? It's night sometimes. It's day sometimes.
I may have mentioned this on the show before, but I remember driving from Atlanta to LA,
mm-hmm.
which was an amazing road trip. And then you and I got to take an almost similar one out to Utah.
Yeah.
But when I drove from Atlanta to LA, and I was in the desert, you know, crossing Texas and New Mexico and Arizona for hours and hours and hours and hours, like a full day of driving out there, driving my car at 70, 80 miles an hour. And I just wondered, there were explorers here, even pre-colonial, there were people who walked out to the desert, saw nothing but desert in front of them for as far as they could see, and said, yeah, let's keep going. No, I'm telling you, on the other side of this, there's going to be palm trees and water. It's going to be great.
Yeah.
And then they probably spent days and days walking and then said, let's keep going. Keep at it. And that, to me, is a level of human ambition that I guess I don't know if we have anymore. I certainly don't.
I think we have it, but it's so much more specialized.
Well,
because what's left to explore, but
space,
ocean, and
yeah,
space,
ocean,
and
space,
you need
yep.
kind of, you know, specialized equipment for that. At least
right.
back then, you could just walk
right
until you found something new. But Tony Horwitz said that in his book Voyage Long and Strange.
Oh yeah,
he was talking about the conquistadors coming up through Mexico
uh-huh.
and walking through the plains. And he's like, at some point, they were in the middle of summer in their freaking armor. Like, uh-huh. they were wearing full conquistador gear. And it's hot and they're sweating. And he's like, all they can see for miles and miles and miles and miles is nothing but grass.
Yeah.
It's nothing.
Yeah.
It's just like seeing desert.
Yeah.
But it's just grass. No trees, nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, and they decided, let's keep walking.
Whew.
And he was also like, blinking, like, would I do that? I don't think so. I don't think, unless I had got this book advance, I'd probably not be doing it right now.
Amazing.
So anyway, I do admire that. I admire that
yeah.
in the past for sure. I don't,
yeah.
I guess we, like I say, we still have it, but it is yeah. so much more specialized and concentrated into certain fields. So
and a more complicated world,
yeah.
I think, that we
yeah.
live in too, where
very
it's like,
true.
Look, I love space exploration. I'm all for it. I think we need to do more of it,
mm-hmm.
but probably not necessarily the way
yeah.
we're doing it now. Like,
right?
I feel like there's something that's a little more beneficial for everyone and maybe a way to disperse those resources to kind of stabilize things here.
Sounds like a lot of communism,
while
son.
We're like, well.
I was going to say, you can kind of see, though, I don't know. I mean, this is just off the top of my head, but you can kind of see as we discovered more and more of the world around us
yeah.
and had a better picture of what was happening out there.
Yeah.
And there was less to explore out there. The more we started turning inward and trying to understand our own human experience
oh, yeah, sure.
and our own selves, and
sure.
then we started thinking about psychology, and now, of course, we're in a real mental health, like, kind of renaissance, it feels like.
Yeah.
Like people are like, no, this is, everyone should be in therapy. Like, you don't
yeah.
need to experience a traumatic event to need
right.
therapy. Like, we should all be examining why and what and who and where these biases are coming from, or unconscious thought patterns or
mm-hmm.
whatever. So I guess you could kind of, I don't know, I'm just kind of seeing, like, these people were looking out and seeing a lot to go find
yeah.
that was not, had anything to do with me,
mm-hmm.
myself, and I. But, like, as we progressed in that way and
yeah,
discovered
so we
more
finished
and more,
exploring.
We kind of had to make it smaller almost
yeah.
and turn inwards and look
yeah.
at this.
Because all those explorers had rampant ADD and depression. And, just
and alcoholism.
right, yeah. Well, no, and then somewhere in between that is me and Dorothy Putnam, who are like, mm-hmm. my therapy is to travel.
I would just like a
I would
South
rather
American vacation.
Explore, please.
yes.
That sounds great.
Yeah. Yeah,
including
true.
The Arctic. I would mm-hmm. totally go to Baffin Island.
Oh, yeah.
I would love to check it out up there.
Sure.
I hope if you are Inuit or know anyone who is,
yeah.
set us up.
Yeah.
I would love to come. Here's the thing, and I've mentioned it before. This hurts me in travel. I'm a vegetarian.
Mm-hmm.
That includes fish.
Yep.
And I guess I'll just have to pack a snack is what I'm saying.
It will be hard. It's going to be hard to feed you sometimes.
The only food up there is
yeah.
fish. But, you know, I'll work it out. I always do.
Mm-hmm.
So I would love to come visit
yeah.
Northern Canada, Greenland, the Arctic.
Oh my God. We have gotten a couple of offers to crash with some of our listeners in their amazing places in Scotland or in Munich or a couple places.
Yeah.
I want you to know that we're taking you incredibly seriously.
yes.
And I am writing a whole tour down for us where we can crash on your couch. So
really
don't offer
so.
Unless you mean it.
Oh, man.
Because we will descend upon you.
yeah.
And
yeah.
then make you show us around.
yes. I am ready.
Yeah, I am so ready. So if you would like, please reach out and tell us what you thought about this episode,
yes.
what you think about Tukulitu and Epirvik or any of these dumbasses they were helping out. or if you have an offer to crash on your couch somewhere cool, we can travel. We would love to hear that too.
Absolutely.
Our email is romance@iheartmedia.com.
Or you can find us on social media. I'm at Oh Great It's Eli on Twitter and Instagram.
I'm Diana Might Boom.
And the show is at Ridic Romance.
Yeah.
So please reach out. Let us know what you thought.
Mm-hmm.
And if we made any errors,
obviously.
Please correct us, as
yeah.
usual.
Mm-hmm.
But hopefully not. And we will see you at the next episode.
Right. So, angai and nakarmik
yeah.
for listening.
Nakarmik.
So long, friends. It's time to go. Thanks for listening to our show. Tell your friends, neighbors, uncles, and aunts to listen to our show, Ridiculous Romance.